And welcome to another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. This is Dr. Z, and welcome to everyone for joining us. So glad you could be here. And we have a great program in store for you today. We have the holistic pharmacist, Sherry Torkos, who's going to be talking about all kinds of things to stay in shape and get our guts in shape. So we'll be talking about that in a bit. So we're really excited again. Always bring you cutting edge holistic radio, and I'm a naturopathic physician and professor at the University of Bridgeport College of Naturopathic Medicine, where I teach lots of classes. And of course, the natural nurse is a holistic nurse and has her PhD in public health, and also is an herbalist and certified holistic nurse. And we bring you this cutting edge information every week right here on Progressive Radio Network, and you can always get more information on our websites. That's drznaturally.com and naturalnurse.com. So let's talk about our guest, Sherry Torkos. She's a registered pharmacist, a holistic pharmacist, former fitness instructor, and author of The GI Made Simple, The Proven Way to Lose Weight, Boost Energy, and Cut Your Risk of Disease. She says that we need to reframe our approach to exercise and eating in order to counter our shelter-at-home physiques, which has kind of maybe happened over the last year or so. The pandemic has caused a lot of changes in our lifestyle, including not moving as much and indulging in at-home comfort foods, working from home, limiting travel, and not having many places to go or people to see has made weight management in some of us, particularly some constitutions, a much harder hurdle to clear, even for a healthy person. So she's going to share with us ways to reverse the sedentary trend and get ourselves moving. Sherry, welcome.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Welcome. With my patients, I tease them. I say it's vitamin MYBA, move your buns around.
I like that.
Yeah.
There's no substitute for movement and exercise.
Yeah, I mean, if you go back to our physiology as probably hunter-gatherers, we would go a long time maybe without food and would have to walk and kind of chase it down quite a bit until we became a more agrarian society. So that is not being experienced by a lot of people. We have easy to get food and we can eat all the time. We don't give ourselves our guts time to rest. We'll talk about the gut because that's like the foundation of health, naturopathic medicine. I mean, all the old time naturopaths always said, when in doubt, treat the gut. Was our old philosophical aphorism. So, but let's focus on exercise. So if we've gained weight, there's a lot of reasons for why people gain weight. So let's talk a little bit about the physiology of weight gain. It's more complex than just calories in, calories out at this stage of the game, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, years ago, we used to think it was much more simplistic, you know, just eat less and exercise more. But now we know the quality of calories matters. So having, you know, some fruits and vegetables, you know, a certain amount of calories is much different than if you were how that's treated in the body versus if you're having a couple cookies made with refined flour. So our body responds to different foods differently in terms of switching on certain hormones and triggering reactions with insulin and blood sugar. Certainly, you know, with this pandemic, I have, you know, been speaking to so many patients, friends, family members that have been struggling because when we are under a stress, a lot of people tend to eat more and not always make the best choices. So they're, you know, gravitating towards comfort foods, things that give you that quick fix, that feel good in the moment. And for a lot of people, that is the refined and starchy carbohydrates. It's the cookies, the breads, the pies, the baked goods, the donuts, the muffins, things that, you know, once in a while in moderation, not so bad. But when we're sitting at home and we're not getting as much activity, we're eating more of those foods. And a lot of reports have, you know, suggested that people are also drinking more alcohol. again, in moderation, a little bit of wine here or there, not so bad. But, you know, if people are putting back a six pack of beer every day, or, you know, drinking, you know, more than a couple glasses of wine, you know, all of those things lead to changes in our body chemistry. They lead to weight gain for sure. And then they also affect our mood and our just our overall feeling of well-being. And I know it's tough. I mean, this pandemic has been hard on everybody, but, you know, my philosophy really is, let's not do anything drastic here, but let's just make some smart choices. Let's exercise a little bit more, build some activity into your day. And I have some tips and strategies on how people can do that.
What about the age-old adage that people just forget to drink water and they confuse hunger with thirst? I've seen that be a big problem with a certain, you know, caliber of patients. They tend to never drink water. And when I question them, I'm like, wow, you know, now true, they might be getting some water in their fruit, and they call that structured water now, which is real good for our cells. But that's interesting, where people don't drink water. So that's one interesting habit. Do you ever encounter that?
Yeah, for sure. I think drinking water is really important. And obviously, we know water is important for, you know, 70% of our body's made up of water. I mean, we need to make sure that we're adequately hydrated, because by the time we feel thirst, we're already starting to get dehydrated. And that can affect your mood, your mental energy. Certainly, you can feel hungrier. I recommend, you know, sipping water throughout the day. But especially if you are doing some exercise, you're outdoors and, you know, going for walks and bike rides, replenishing those vital fluids. And rather than going for some of the, you know, the water industry has boomed so much over the last few years. There's so many flavored waters and waters with a lot of things added to them. In some cases, they're, you know, high in calories as well, with a lot of added, you know, sugar and artificial sweeteners that we don't need. I'm big on, you know, just squeezing a little bit of orange or a lemon or lime into the water. I try to offer that when I have people over or outside, you know, even with my son, who is at that age where he's aware that other kids drink more juice and soda, and he wants that. And I always try to give him, you know, a sparkling water with some squeezes of fruit, or I would plop in some blueberries or raspberries to jazz it up a bit. And it's hydrating and it's refreshing and it tastes good.
So what bad lifestyle habits have you seen people have during this pandemic and stick and be difficult for them to break?
Well, I think the whole like overeating and snacking, and just because we're sedentary and a lot of people have been, you know, confined to home working, you know, if you're sitting at your desk and you have a bag of potato chips, you may think, oh, I'm just going to have a few, but rarely, do we ever just have the actual serving size of, say, potato chips or whatever the snack food may be. Often, you know, that bag sits there, and before you know it, you've, you know, eaten two or three times what you anticipated. So snacking, I think, has been one difficult habit. Drinking more alcohol has been another one. I think a lot of people turn to alcohol when they're feeling stressed or worried, and as a way of, you know, temporarily making them feel better. But, you know, of course, alcohol brings with it a lot of calories, and it disrupts your sleep, and you know, okay in a little bit, but when we're having too much of it, definitely can be an issue. And then the lack of activity. I think for those that are used to going to a gym or being part of a fitness group or a running club or a cycling group or whatever it may be, it's sometimes difficult to think of ways to, you know, just do exercise in your home or by yourself. And so as a former fitness instructor, this is something I'm very passionate about, the importance of movement for the body. And, you know, as you were talking about in the intro, you know, our hunter-gatherer lifestyle, we're so different from that today in that we have all these quick convenience foods, drive-throughs. You know, the average person is definitely not getting enough physical activity. But I always talk to people about changing your mindset, not looking at exercise as, you know, a burden or something that's uncomfortable and painful, and really focusing on the rewards in terms of how you have more energy, you get your blood flowing, your brain feels better, you can think more clearly, it revitalizes your mind, your body, you burn more calories, and it doesn't have to be necessarily going out for a power jog or anything super intense, but building little bits of exercise and activity into your day, even things you can do in your while you're sitting at your desk to move your body, all of those little things are good for your health.
Why do you think people sabotage themselves on a mental, emotional level? Like they, I'm joining a gym. They join a gym and then they just don't go. Is there a psychology that you've seen? I know we're going to talk a lot about physiology and exercise and moving, but is there almost like a mindset that people get on themselves? Because I found that that's sometimes is the medicine. You know, what's happening in the universe, in the mind, is actually the thing that people have to deal with, you know?
Yeah, I think there's a few things at play there. I mean, people could have the good intentions of joining a fitness center or, you know, downloading an app and doing the exercise. But sometimes, you know, we bite off more than we can handle, right? If you're signing up for something that is beyond your fitness level, and if you're doing the activity or the class or the exercise and it's painful or you're not doing it properly and you get hurt, or in some cases it's intimidating for people that are out of shape. And I know I was a volunteer instructor at our local YMCA for many, many years. And I, you know in talking to a lot of like women, you know, middle age, especially that haven't previously exercised, they get intimidated about the thoughts of getting into form fitting clothing, being out exercising in front of other people. And so I think there's a lot at play there. And, you know, once we can break down some of those barriers and, you know, even just think of things that we can do to build activity within our own comfort level at our homes, you know, going outdoors for the little walks, all of that can make a big difference.
Right. Like the doing stuff that's meaningful and private. Like you have a whole series of desk exercises that one can do. Let's talk about some of them.
Yeah, and I'm actually doing some of them right now as we're talking. I don't like to sit at my desk unless I absolutely have to, because I have lower back issues. And when I'm sitting at my desk for a long period of time, my lower back is just, it's killing me. And, you know, it's all of those years of, you know, snowboarding and water skiing and all of the things that I did in my 20s and 30s that have, you know, come back to me now in that I'm in my 50s. And so for me, when I'm talking to somebody, whether it's on, you know, in like Skype right now as we're chatting, or if I'm on the phone, I'm moving around, I'm doing calf raises. Sometimes I'll do squats and lunges. As long as I'm not getting out of breath, I can kind of get away with it and nobody knows what I'm, you know, actually doing, but I'm moving my body. If I'm sitting down, I can lift my heels up off the floor and do calf raises. That's great for promoting circulation. People can experience leg swelling and worsening of varicose veins and circulatory issues. If you're just sitting at your desk for a long time and you're not moving, blood can start to pool in your ankles and your extremities, and you get swelling, and it doesn't feel good, and it can get aching and pain. So if you can just do some calf raises, if you can if you're sitting at a desk where you have a fixed chair with armrests, you can put the palms of your hand on the edge of your desk. If your desk is strong and it's not going to move, and you can do push-ups against your desk, you can do squats with your chair. So you just stand up away from your desk and just squat down as though you were going to be sitting down on your chair, but just don't sit all the way down. Those types of exercises are great for the legs. Squats work so many muscle groups in your legs. And it's, again, a great way to promote better circulation.
Absolutely. Those are all wonderful suggestions. And they don't realize that they're actually doing exercise, that those actually benefit them, but they really do. I think maybe getting an ergonomic desk, you know, if you can afford that could be a very good suggestion as well. I like that idea.
Yeah, the desks that you could stand behind, and some of them have modified levels. I think those are really helpful. They're a little bit pricey, but I know some people that have made their own ergonomic desks. If you, you know, you have somebody in the house that's handy to put something like that together, it's helpful. And the other thing I was going to say is that, you know, if you have a busy day with a lot of meetings, chances are you probably have 10, 15 minutes, you know, here and there in between meetings. Rather than going to the refrigerator, take that 10 or 15 minutes to do some more intense bursts of activity. And it could be jumping jacks. It could be going up and down the stairs, jogging on the spot, you know, doing walking lunges. That's another really good exercise. I do a lot of those walking lunges. So you're just kind of stepping forward and lunging. But rather than doing it in place, you can do it if you have a hallway to go up and down. But take that 10 or 15 minutes. And, you know, seriously, it makes a difference. You think, oh, 10 minutes, that's not enough to do a workout. It really is. 10 minutes, you can get your heart going, you can get the blood pumping, and then you can, you know, revitalize your body.
So is it true that when we're gaining weight, that our muscle mass is going down? Not necessarily, I guess. And does building muscle help us with weight loss?
Yeah, if we're building muscle, building lean muscle, we know that muscle burns more calories than fat. The more muscle you have, the higher your metabolism runs, the more calories you burn. So I you know, often say to people, don't get fixated with the scale, because you jump on the scale and you see, you know, a certain amount of pounds. And if it's not changing a lot, but yet you're eating better, you're exercising more, the scale doesn't measure your body composition. So you're better off to go by how your clothes fit, how you look in the front of the mirror, how you're feeling, than just using your body weight as a gauge in terms of how you're doing.
Yeah, because, I mean, you could be picking on water. There could be other factors associated with, you know, temporarily hormonal fluctuations, like aldosterone causes you to absorb more water. Maybe it's a hot day and you've imbibed in too much salt. So that's a great idea. Now, don't be fixated by the scale. I love that, because that can short circuit people and throw them off course, because then they get upset and then they throw the whole program. They throw out the baby with the bathwater, as they say.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, women in particular, throughout the month, the changes in our menstrual cycle, our weight can fluctuate by a couple of pounds just in water retention throughout the month. A lot of women experience, you know, bloating and water retention around the time of their menstrual cycle. So, you know, again, looking at the scale doesn't tell the full picture.
Now, when people are worrying and things like that, their sleep might be disturbed. And we now know that sleep is very important for weight management. Tell us a little bit about some of the research that you've uncovered and discussed about the benefits of sleep.
Yeah, so sleep, it's so interesting, because we always think of sleep as a passive state, right? You know, a lot of people think, oh, I'm just laying there, I'm sleeping. And, you know, it's one of the first things that gets thrown by the wayside when we're busy, right? We stay up later, we put more work into our day, and we kind of go ahead and skimp on the sleep. And yet sleep is a time when our body is actually very busy repairing and regenerating, producing hormones that regulate so many body processes. And there's been a lot of research in the past 20 years or so to indicate that a lack of sleep can create a hormonal environment that can lead to weight gain. When we're not getting enough sleep at night, and it seems to be that magic number is, if we're not getting at least 6 hours of sleep at night, that can throw things out of whack in our system. It can upset levels of a hormone called ghrelin, which is involved in appetite regulation. If you have increased levels of ghrelin, that can increase your appetite. There's affiliations with human growth hormone. When we're not getting enough sleep at night, HGH, or human growth hormone, levels can be reduced. And that hormone's involved in regulating metabolism. So if we have lower levels of growth hormone, that can reduce your metabolism. I mean, there's so much research in this area. It's very fascinating. I recall one study where people who slept, I think it was 5 hours per night. So again, we're talking less than six. 5 hours 73% more likely to become obese than those people who are getting 7 to 9 hours of sleep. So, there's just many reasons why we need to sleep more. I mean, we know that when we don't sleep enough at night, we're mentally tired, we're foggy. We don't always make the best decisions too, right? If you're tired, you often crave more sweets because you want that quick burst of energy, the sugary things. You have to look at the benefits. If you're getting more sleep at night, it's going to help your weight loss efforts. But also, when you get more sleep at night, it's good for your immune system. It's good for your energy levels, your ability to think clearly the next day. So a whole lot of reasons why sleep should actually be a priority.
Yeah, and then we know, of course, some of the physiology with serotonin and sleep, serotonin, when I do some neurotransmitter research on patients' evaluations, we find often that they're night eaters. Like they love, like they could finish a meal, but then they just don't feel satisfied unless they have something before they go to bed. And there could be other reasons like that. Like I've uncovered that sometimes patients have nocturnal hypoglycemia, and that sometimes is a compensatory behavior to deal with that. And that could be interrupting their sleep because in the middle of the night, they get a burst of cortisol or epinephrine because their blood sugar's gone down too low. And then, the adrenals compensate and et cetera, et cetera. But what's interesting is that, having low serotonin sometimes makes you a night eater. And there was an old saying, eat after eight, gain weight. You ever hear of that one, Sherry?
Yes, I have. And yes, that's true. You raise a really good point. I know in talking to a lot of patients that this seems to be an issue where, they don't eat all day and then it's late in the evening and in the middle of the night, they have all of these things happening where they're, could wake up and they're ravenous and big snacks before bed or big meals before bed, which is not ideal.
Yeah. So anyway, let's talk a little bit about some other things that you want to mention, like the glycemic index. You mentioned that was a very critical part of managing insulin, and it's these insulin spikes. Maybe you can talk about that, explain that to the listeners. They may not understand all the complexities around insulin. They think maybe, I'm not a diabetic, why should I worry about insulin?
Right. I mean, insulin's important for everybody, keeping good control of your insulin and blood sugar levels, not just a diabetic concern. Something that I've written about in my book, The GI Made Simple. So in that case, the GI refers to the glycemic index, is the importance of following or choosing as much as possible slow-release carbohydrates in your diet. They are lower in the glycemic index. So the glycemic index, this measures the rate at which carbohydrates are broken down into sugar in your system. So foods that have a high glycemic index are broken down really quickly. And you can think of those foods as the refined starchy carbohydrates, the things we always hear we should stay away from, the white breads and the white pastas and things like that. The reason why these foods are problematic is when we eat foods with a high glycemic index, again, quick release, broken down into sugar very quickly, they cause our insulin levels to spike. And when insulin levels spike, that's often accompanied by a subsequent dropping in blood sugar. I call this like the blood sugar roller coaster. You're feeling good when you're eating those sweets, say that, white bread. And then that's accompanied by the dropping off. Once insulin's released, your blood sugar goes down and you're feeling tired and sluggish and hungry. But we also know that these fluctuations in insulin and blood sugar also contribute to weight gain. So it becomes a bit of a vicious cycle because you're getting that quick fix, that starchy carbohydrate. You feel good for a short time. Your blood sugar and insulin levels drop off. Then you're craving more and the cycle goes on and on. So what I talk about is the importance, again, of trying to eat as much as possible foods that process more slowly into sugar. So think of high fiber, carbohydrates, vegetables, fruits. You can never go wrong when you're eating raw vegetables and fruits, and even, you know, to some extent, some cooked ones are okay, but as eating them raw and in their natural state is really the way to go, and beans and legumes. And if you're having, you know, your breads, mixing it with a protein and a fat to slow down the glycemic response or how it's broken down in your body. So you're better off, for example, to have a piece of toast with some almond butter on it or some sliced avocado or cottage cheese or something like that versus just having the plain bread by itself. When you eat the carbohydrate with the healthy fat and the protein, it'll keep you feeling sustained longer and energized longer, and that's going to be better for your blood sugar and your insulin levels, as well as your energy levels and your weight management.
So there are lists of these foods. I guess they abound on the internet, like what would be considered a high glycemic index food versus a low one, so that patients, and maybe there's apps that they can put on their phone that when they go shopping, I guess.
Tons of apps and great websites where you can find low versus high glycemic foods. Again, when it comes to good choices, low glycemic foods, you really can't go wrong with fruits, vegetables. When you're having breads, rye bread, sourdough, or the multigrain seed breads, things that have more fiber in them, fiber slows down the rate of digestion and the processing of how your body processes those carbohydrates. So forget the white bread. I think a lot of people know that's not good for you. Go with the multi-whole grain. And even with pastas, I mean, there's so many great pasta options today. You know, think outside your comfort zone. Maybe try some of the chickpea pasta or the quinoa pasta. There's some really great options. I remember sampling some chickpea pasta at Expo West a couple of years ago, and I thought it was just fantastic. And I got my son onto that, and you know, slowly trying to get my husband away from his regular wheat pasta onto some of the healthier options. But I think it's, you know, a matter of experimenting with some of these things.
That's interesting, because I guess one person's food is another one's poison, because the chickweed pasta kept me up all night with the runs, not to be graphic on the show. But so I guess my gut has a little bit more work to do to accommodate the breaking down of those legumes, or maybe it's the flora, which is a great segue to talk about a lot of the questions that we want to cover today, which is your, you know, the gut flora. You know, the gut flora is very interesting. They've done so much more mapping, starting from Eli Michnikoff way back in the 1800s, when he was talking about, you know, death begins in the colon, and all these amazing aphorisms that are, you know, spouted by folks, to, of course, the renowned professor, one of my professors at Bastyr, Dr. Bland, who taught briefly and lots of courses, and his work, of course, his research is amazing. We're talking about the 4R program, which is the aphorism that we use in naturopathic and functional medicine thinking, doctors and pharmacists and folks, chiropractors, et cetera, to think about what we have to do to keep the gut balanced. So the 4Rs stand for RID. I actually, because I've been a professor for 30 years, I kind of changed it. So I use rekindle. Rekindle the digestive fire based on Ayurvedic and Chinese ideas about that, you know, we need a good, strong digestive system and enzymes to break down the food. Repairing the gut lining and repairing a lot of the different inflammatory problems. And then repopulate, and there's even repopulate, which people know about by doing what's called fecal transplantation, and people with very, very severe GI problems. But, you know, that's more for physicians and practitioners to understand. From a layperson's perspective, tell us a little bit about our gut flora. Some people have read these amazing facts that it's like a whole organ, newly discovered organ, like your brain and your liver, your microbiome. Tell us a little bit about your research on it and what you talk about in your book.
Yeah, so it is quite fascinating what we've learned about the microbiome over the last couple of decades, certainly since I've started practicing, you know, awareness of the importance of the beneficial bacteria in your gut. We refer to them as the probiotics, the for life, the good bacteria. You know, since I've been practicing, this has been, there's just been a huge evolution in our understanding of the important role that the beneficial bacteria in your body play, not just in gut health. So regulating, say, your bowel habits and things that are going on in the digestive tract, but for supporting immune health, cardiovascular health, and even in weight management. I mean, there's been some, and I'm sure you're aware of some of the studies that have found that there's less diverse microflora in obese individuals than there is in people that have a lean body mass. And I know there have been some interesting studies of transplantations going on in animals. I don't know if that's quite happened yet in humans, but it's fascinating to really delve into what's going on in our microbiome and the fact that these beneficial bacteria that are in our system. So really from mouth, we're talking from mouth to bottom end, our bodies are lined with billions of bacteria. And I think it's around 85% or so of those are good and beneficial. And then we have some that are not so good and some that are associated with disease and health risks and infections and a lot of other problems. So I talk to patients often about the importance of supporting gut health, their beneficial bacteria, by first and foremost, a healthy, clean diet. We know that including foods in your diet, such as yogurt and kefir and fermented foods, kombucha and tempeh, they provide us with some beneficial bacteria that can support gut health. But also to feed those probiotics, we want to get prebiotics in our diet. And prebiotics, think of those as the fibers that feed the probiotics. So they're nourishment or fertilizer for the beneficial bacteria in our gut. So your prebiotic foods are things like bananas and asparagus and artichokes, onions, garlic. All of these foods provide nourishment for the beneficial bacteria. So in addition to getting your fermented dairy, and if you can tolerate dairy, usually you know, people will take those in food form and then maybe also a supplement. And what's really become a popular way to get the benefits of both the probiotics and prebiotics is to take something called a synbiotic. And here we're talking about symbiotic, a pre and probiotic, because they have a symbiotic relationship. So there's one in particular that has some really good clinically researched ingredients that I take myself. And it's by Wakanaga. They've done just so much research in the area of pre and probiotics. It's called Pro Plus Synbiotic, and it provides with your body with 2 grams of a clinically studied prebiotic fiber, along with 20 billion CFUs of probiotics, 9 different strains clinically researched. And so it's a great way to get, again, the benefits of the pre and the probiotic. Because I know in talking to a lot of people, you know, they eat a little bit of yogurt, they eat a little bit of this and a little bit of that, but they don't always get the consistent, a consistent amount of these foods in their diet on a daily basis. So that's where I think a supplement can help to bridge the gap and support good health for the gut and beyond. Because again, pre and probiotics, good for so many other areas of your system, weight management, immune system, and other areas.
Well, you know, folks come to me and other practitioners so we can actually map out their GI system and look at it and look at some of the, what they call cornerstone or foundational probiotics, and then also look at the, kind of like Clint Eastwood movie, the good, the bad, and the ugly. Because there are some, and we may need to, you know, I always use the garden analogy, Sherry. You don't want to be throwing grass seeds on your lawn when it's just covered in weeds. You want to till the soil and get the soil proper so that you're going to get maximal extermination. A lot of people, it's interesting because, you know, I've been practicing for over 30 years, and on every patient, I run a stool analysis. Every patient that comes to my office, and I've seen many people both at my private office and teaching as a professor at University of Bridgeport. And I find that sometimes in using some of the products and probiotics, they don't take. Like, they could be using these things, and then I reculture their stool, and I look, and the probiotics did not grab hold. They didn't take root. And again, using the garden analogy, if you till the soil before you plant the seeds, a lot of times you have better, transplantation. So it's kind of interesting.
That's right.
I was going to say. I've noticed that for many years.
Yeah, I agree 100%. We can't, you know, supplements aren't going to just, you know, be the magic bullet for replacing what's missing or what's, you know, disrupted in the system. I think, you know, when you look at the probiotic supplements that are out there too today, there's such a wide range in quality and potency. And that's why I think it's so important when you are looking to take a probiotic. And I field a lot of questions. I'm actually an advisor on a website, probiotics.com. And it's important to look for clinically studied strains and probiotics that are shown to survive stomach acid, that are shown to have, you know, be able to implant where they need to. They have to be able to set up home in your digestive tract, and also stability of probiotics. I mean, there's some that they aren't shelf stable, if they have to be refrigerated, and you know, the potency and survivability of these live microorganisms is a real issue. So going with clinically studied strains, products that have guaranteed potency until expiry and that have been shown to implant in the digestive tract, that's really an important consideration.
Now, certain strains pertain to our subject matter, which is gaining weight during pandemic and whatnot. And some of them help with, again, reducing blood sugar, like you mentioned. Oh, yeah, that study you mentioned. Yeah, they took identical rats and that were twins, and they put the flora of an obese human into the rat, and they fed them a particular diet, and the ones that had the obese flora and the particular standard American diet combination, those rats became morbidly obese, whereas the other rats were able to kind of handle the junk food diet and didn't really gain a tremendous amount of weight. That was interesting when I read that.
Yeah,
story. I actually presented
very interesting.
That at the restorative form. I presented that at a conference. Very interesting finding. Yeah, so the you're right. The bacteria in your gut plays a huge role in maybe weight loss, weight gain, and suppressing appetite and reducing abdominal fat and many, many parameters. What did your research and readings talk about?
Yeah, you know, there's various strains of lactobacillus and bifidobacteria. Those are two families of bacteria that have been shown in studies to reduce body weight, belly fat, which I know is a big issue for a lot of folks, that, you know, midlife spread that occurs. Lactobacillus gasseri appears to be one of the most effective, and there's a good level of evidence around that. So it's fascinating. Probiotics have definitely been shown to be a partner in weight management. I mean, there's also evidence that they can help to promote the release of appetite-reducing hormones. They may help to reduce the number of calories that you absorb from food, and prebiotics too. The prebiotics we're talking about, you know, those fibers that feed the probiotics, there's evidence that they can also help with weight management through supporting satiety, which is that feeling of fullness we get when we eat a meal. So that's, again, I think a pro plus symbiotic, that combination of the pre and the probiotic can be helpful in many areas.
Plus, I know there's research that a lot of the serotonin that we make in our body is actually made in the gut. And that seems to be very important for controlling behavior. I mean, we had an interesting story. We had a man with OCD tendencies at the clinic in Bridgeport. And so, you know, he was on all kinds of medications and things like that. And one thing we decided to do is look at his gut flora as part of our holistic management of the case. And we noticed, you know, that his gut flora was very awry. So we did the 4R program. First, we rid the body of bad habits, like not chewing your food, by the way, because if you don't chew your food, you leave undigested food for the bugs to maybe proliferate. And if it's a bad bug, what I found is a bad bug could live off a prebiotic just as much as a good bug, like Klebsiella pneumoniae can actually grow. And that is one of the pathogens that we look for, can actually grow on the prebiotic. So again, weeding before you seed is the whole gardening thing that I always drill into my students' minds. So we did some weeding. I think we used berberine, which is, you know, I think the stool analysis showed that berberine and a little bit of grapefruit seed extract were the most effective botanicals to kind of suppress some of the bad biotics. And then we, you know, made sure that he was digesting his food properly, so that, again, and tried to change that eating habits, like not eating when you're driving your car, not eating too late, you know, after 8, gain weight type of thing. So we tried changing those things. Lo and behold, without any additional supplementation of tryptophan or other things like that, his serotonin levels came up to normal and his OCD symptoms ameliorated tremendously.
That's remarkable.
So that we got comments from his psychiatrist and psychologist that whatever we were doing was amazing. And all we did is we treated his gut, Sherry.
Yeah, clean up the gut. I mean, we think of the gut, so many people just think of it as what's going on with their eating and pooping, and they don't realize the far-reaching effects that if something's out of whack in your gut, it affects your emotional well-being. And I've experienced that too with patients that, you know, getting them on a better path with their digestive tract literally can help improve, OCD, depression, anxiety, people sleep better at night. And then, of course, you know, good for your immune system. We can't underestimate the importance of having good gut health. And I like the weed before you seed. I've been doing a little bit of that outside as well myself.
Yes, it's a very important concept, that's for sure, in gardening. But we're just, you know, the old-time naturopaths like Dr. Lynn Lahr and Dr. Luce said that our gut was soil just like the garden, and we want to be good hosts. We want to be good hosts to the good living things and not good hosts to viruses and other pathogens, you know, because the pathogens, Sherry, have been linked to things like rheumatoid arthritis and psoriasis and ankylosing spondylitis and autoimmune diseases. There's even evidence that certain strains of Yersinia bacteria have been linked to autoimmune thyroiditis like Hashimoto. So the gut flora is just profound in its crosstalk with the brain, the immune system, and we're talking about today, weight loss and metabolic syndrome. I it's just fascinating.
It totally is. Yeah, I mean, who would have thought how important, you know, these beneficial bacteria, these probiotics, the microbiome would be for health. And I think, you know, the level of research that's going on in here, too, is just astounding. Like hundreds of studies coming out every week looking at the far-reaching effects that our microbiome has on our health and the relationship that they that these bacteria have with their environment around them.
Now, you mentioned that the diet should have a variety of different things. Do they know what foods seem to trigger the growth of various strains of probiotics? So I know, for instance, like if you were to take the Lactobacillus gasseri for a while, you're basically saying by taking the prebiotics, you can keep them growing in your intestine because these are living organisms. It's not just like, like a static vitamin that you take and then you pee out the next day. These are living microorganisms, almost like a farm growing and raising chickens or cows or sheep or whatever like that. Are we thinking about that correctly? These are like living organisms?
Yeah, that's right. And I think that when it comes to the prebiotic fibers, they're present in lots of different foods. But what I find in talking to people, they don't always get on a consistent basis enough of the prebiotics to provide what we deem to be an ideal situation to nourish the probiotics. I mean, artichokes, some people love them, some people hate them. Asparagus, I love asparagus myself, but it's a strong flavored vegetable. While it's great in that it's high in prebiotic fiber, it's maybe not something that you're getting on a regular basis. But onions and garlic, things like that, I think most people eat, but they, probably eat a little bit here and there. And that's again where I think, supplements can be helpful. The one that I mentioned, the Pro Plus Symbiotic that I take, it actually has a prebiotic called BioEcolens. And this particular one has been shown in research to contribute to actually have a positive effect on improving the population of the lactobacilli and bifidobacteria. And so I think that's important, that you're looking at a specific prebiotic fiber that's been shown in a number of clinical studies to have a positive effect, not just on feeding and improving the levels, the population of these probiotic bacteria, but also in real outcomes where it's improving digestive function. I believe they've also done some studies with irritable bowel and also with satiety and weight management. So I think that's a good choice.
So now one interesting question that patients have is when should they take probiotics? And I think there's as many answers as there are, stars in the universe. I've trained my students in one way because that's the way I learn. But is there anything that you've come across in your readings as the best time to take probiotics, the morning, evening, before bed, with food, without food, enterically coated or not? There's so many that, you read the internet and it's confusing to patients. So why don't you give at least your opinion as one of the stars in the universe?
you're right. It's you do hear different advice when it comes to that. Do you take it on with food or an empty stomach? Some manufacturers say take it on an empty stomach. Others advise taking it with food. Perhaps that's because they're studies on specific strains have yielded different results. What I would say to people is don't take your a few do's and don'ts. I would say take it at a consistent time of day when you're going to remember it first and foremost. I would say, to take it, ideally maybe with a small meal. But I wouldn't take it with a large meal, and I would, not take it with alcohol. That would be another thing, high amounts of alcohol, because that's thought to have a negative impact. What do you typically tell your students?
Same thing. I like taking them at night because I don't know, the it seems like when we're in a parasympathetic state, we seem to do a lot of healing. So I read, and I don't know, some of the old masters talked about
eating a meal.
You know, like, no, actually before bed.
Just before bed.
Right before bed, yeah. A lot of it maybe had to do with, we didn't maybe have fancy strains back in the old days, and we wanted to make sure that, you know, hydrochloric acid in the stomach is the enemy of many germs. A part of our, one of our defensive mechanisms is the hydrochloric acid in our stomach, you know, kills hopefully parasites and pathogens from foods and whatnot. So if you think about it, you know, our, one of our greater defensive systems, having that strong hydrochloric acid and other enzymes in the stomach, is to kind of keep the bacteria lower. So we want to make sure that the strains of bugs survive the acid bath of our. So if we eat a huge meal, like you mentioned, that food's going to stay in the stomach for hours and hours and churn and churn and churn and reach a pH of 1 to 2. And then, you know, eventually go into the pancreatic phase of digestion. And a little microorganism like that doesn't really stand a chance of surviving, you know, in that milieu. Whereas if we take it with a smaller meal or a particular beverage or whatnot, then there's a good chance that we're not going to engage our hydrochloric acid so much, and then it will survive and get into the small and large intestine. I mean, that's kind of physiology. I know I've had debates on the air with different physicians and experts in this, like that, and even at conferences, which is kind of fun. We all went out for a beer afterwards, so there was no, you know, no harm done in the debate. But where I presented evidence that that was true, and then some of the other doctors evidence, now you can take probiotics whenever you want, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know. I thought maybe.
Yeah. I don't know if there is just one answer. Yes, you know, but exactly. I tend to, like you, I tend to tell people to stay away from having them with big meals because, yes, of the whole hydrochloric acid situation. But it's important to also make sure they take it at a time of day that they'll remember. I find in the morning for a lot of people, the morning routines can be rushed and it's just not really the ideal time, you know, to take something like that. In the evening is I always say with like a light meal, a light snack or on an empty stomach in the evening, but definitely you don't want to be taking it with a massive meal or a lot of alcohol. And, you know, I've also heard that caffeine can also potentially affect the survivability of probiotics. So another reason why I don't tend to recommend them in the morning.
Yeah. So as we get towards the tail end of the program here, we only have a few more minutes. Let's recap and tell us about where we can get a copy of your book and learn more about the great tips that you talked about during the program today.
Sure. So you can check out my website, which is sherrytorkos.com, and that is SHERRYTORKOS, sherrytorkos.com. As I mentioned earlier, I'm also an advisor on probiotics.com, where you can, you know, look at all kinds of interesting information on pre and probiotics. I serve on a panel with other experts, so that's probiotics.com. And just, yeah, as a quick recap, as some of the things we were touching on today about, you know, kind of shaking off the sedentary lifestyle, getting ourselves in this, hopefully in a post-pandemic state, building more activity into your day. I talked about the importance of little bursts of activity, exercises that you can do at your desk, but any activity is better than no activity. So just try to move your body. We talked about eating a low glycemic diet and how that can help curb hunger and appetite, keep your energy levels stabilized and help with weight management. We were talking about pre and probiotics and how they're good for so many areas of health beyond just gut health and digestion, but weight management, immune system. And then we talked about sleep, that vital thing that we all should be getting more of and not skimping on sleep, because if we're not getting enough sleep at night, that can contribute to weight gain along with risks of other health problems. So we, for better health, we all need to make sleep a priority.
Yeah, I think that's true. I tend to stay up late. So I'm going to, after the show, I'm going to turn over a new leaf and go to bed early. All right. Well, any last thoughts? What about research articles? I guess that website would be really good, or go on PubMed or.
PubMed has, and the PubMed is something everybody can access. But, you know, for the layperson, if you don't have a scientific background, reading some of the research articles on PubMed can be a bit daunting. If you go to probiotics.com, what we've done is we've taken interesting, you know, research and information on pre-probiotics and health in general and put it in an easy to understand language. And you can ask questions as well. So if you're wondering about, you know, can I take this with a certain medication? I get a lot of questions like that. You can reach out there to probiotics.com.
That's a good point. That's a good point. There was something I was reading about that certain probiotics enhance a couple of the different botanicals for urinary tract infections. I was reading something about, I don't have it at the tip of my tongue here, but, certain probiotics do interfere with certain medications. So I guess the probiotics.com website would be a good source to check things out with, before people start taking things.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, one common interaction with actually where probiotics, your beneficial bacteria, tend to be depleted or disrupted is when you're taking an antibiotic. And when I'm talking to patients who are taking antibiotics, it's always top of mind to make sure you replace and replenish the beneficial bacteria, because I've seen, you know, patients experience just horrible side effects of antibiotics, not just during the course of antibiotics, but even for weeks or months afterwards. And, you know, there's certainly evidence showing that one course of an antibiotic can disrupt your normal flora for up to 2 years afterwards. So it's really important to consider, if you are taking an antibiotic, to also take a probiotic. And I do recommend them during and after the course of antibiotics. And there are different theories. Absolutely. Some people say, wait till you're done your antibiotics, then start the probiotic. But by then I find people already have diarrhea and thrush and yeast and other things going on. So I tend to recommend them during and then after.
Yeah, I think the literature supports that. So that's very good. Hey, Sherry, it's been a wonderful program. I learned a lot and it was great sharing and creating this great radio program with you. Appreciate it.
Yeah, likewise. Thanks for having me on your show.
Very welcome. And that does it for another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. This is Dr. Z signing out and hoping that you stay healthy, folks. Bye-bye. See you soon.